Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in 2010.
I'm Chris Higashi, the program manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome and thanks for joining us this afternoon. It's a real pleasure to welcome Jody Picot back to the Seattle Public Library. So first, thank you to Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to host this reading. Also to the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, to Real Networks Foundation for sponsoring our author series, and finally to the Seattle Public Library Foundation, whose support makes possible so many of our free library programs. Now let me turn things over to Karen Maeda-Allman from Elliott Bay Book Company to introduce our special guest. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Karen Maeda-Allman from Elliott Bay, as Chris said. Today it's my pleasure to welcome Jody Picot to the Seattle Public Library for a third time. The author of over 17 novels, including My Sister's Keeper, The Pact, Handle with Care. Her books are compelling and they have wonderful sympathetic characters which face dilemmas that reflect many of the important issues families face in our times. Her many awards include a New England Bookseller Award, an Alex Award, a Lifetime Achievement Award for Mainstream Fiction from the Romance Writers of America, and also she's known internationally, and she was a Waterston's Author of the Year in the UK. But her books, I think, have been translated into about 30 different languages or more. Her books are favorites of readers and booksellers alike, and many of you, I've had some great conversations with people this time, and also I suspect possibly the last time Jody was here, and I know that many of you have read all of her books, and you all have favorites. Four of her books have been made into movies, and today, though, she's here with her brand new novel, House Rules, which recently made its debut at the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Now that's not a surprise, it's this story of an advice columnist whose forensics-obsessed teenage son is accused of the murder of his tutor, has received considerable praise both from early readers and from critics alike. This is also the story of a family coping with a child's disability as the son has Asperger's syndrome, and we learn a lot about how this affects his mother, his far-from-perfect younger brother, and other people in his family. The novel also takes us into the mind and heart of the son himself. It's filled with suspense, and it's hard to put down from the first pages. So Jody's going to read from her book and talk about her work in general. She's going to take some questions from the audience, and that's always one of the favorite portions of these talks here. And then afterwards, she'll be signing books at the center table. So please join me in giving a warm Seattle welcome to Jody Picot.
All right, I have one question for you all. It's a sunny day in Seattle. What the hell are you doing here? It's really very nice to be here. I was truly expecting four people, so this is really quite nice. And it's always great to be back in this town. It's a great book town, as I'm sure you all know. I am here to talk about House Rules. And as you heard Karen say, this is a book about a kid who is on the autism spectrum. Jacob Hunt is 18 years old, and he has Asperger's syndrome, which puts him on the high-functioning end of the spectrum. If you don't know a lot about Asperger's syndrome, you're going to know plenty by the time you finish this book. Like many other kids with Asperger's, Jacob is really, really smart. He is obsessed with one particular topic. He doesn't understand social cues at all. He finds it hard to communicate face-to-face with someone. He has a really hard time with empathy and what they call theory of mind, meaning he can't put himself in someone else's shoes, and his world is very self-centered. And he's painfully literal. So if you said, "Jacob, take a seat," he'd walk over there and hand it to you. Jacob's passion, his one special focus, is crime scene analysis. Until that is, he winds up accused of a crime himself. The reason I wanted to write this book is twofold. First of all, because the legal system in America works really well if you communicate a certain way. And if you don't, it just goes to hell in a handbasket very, very quickly. When you think about some of the hallmark behaviors of autism, like not looking someone in the eye, or having some kind of nervous stimulatory behavior, a tic, or speaking in a flat tone or an inappropriate tone with your voice, to a policeman who doesn't know better, that's going to look an awful lot like guilt. And that is the situation that Jacob finds himself in. Well, that's the first reason that I wanted to really write about autism. But there was one other reason, and I've been letting my audiences answer that question for themselves. I want you to raise your hand if you have a child on the autism spectrum or you know a child on the autism spectrum. Look around. 1 out of 100 kids is diagnosed today somewhere on the spectrum, which is why this becomes a very important topic to talk about. So today what you're going to do is hear from several narrators in the book. You're going to be hearing from Emma, who is Jacob's mom. You're going to be hearing from Jacob himself. And then you're going to hear from Rich, who is a local detective in the town of Townsend, Vermont. And to begin with, this is Emma. Everywhere I look, there are signs of a struggle. The mail has been scattered all over the kitchen floor. The stools are overturned. There's one single faint footprint from a van's sneaker at the threshold of the living room, pointing toward the dead body of my son, Jacob. He's sprawled like a starfish in front of the fireplace. Blood covers his temple and his hands. For a moment, I can't move. I can't breathe. Suddenly, he sits up. "Mom," Jacob says, "you are not even trying." "This isn't real," I remind myself. "Oh, there was a fight," I say. "And?" You were hit in the head?" I notice the crystal clock that usually sits on the mantel peeking out from beneath the couch. I gingerly pick it up and see blood on the corner. With my pinky, I touch the liquid and then taste it. "Jacob, don't tell me you used up all my corn syrup again." Jacob sits up and sighs. "There was a confrontation in the kitchen," he says. "It ended with me being chased into the living room where Theo clocked me." At that, I have to smile a little. Just so you know, that means to punch someone, not hit them with an actual clock. Suddenly, Theo thunders down the stairs. "Where is the freak?" he yells. "Theo, you will not call your brother. How about I stop calling my brother a freak when he stops stealing things out of my room?" I've instinctively stepped between him and his brother. "I didn't steal anything from your room," Jacob says. "Oh, really? What about my sneakers?" "They were in the mudroom." "Oh, retard," Theo says under his breath, and I see a flash of fire in Jacob's eyes. "I am not retarded." He lunges for his brother. I hold him off with an outstretched arm. "Jacob, you shouldn't take anything that belongs to Theo without asking for his permission. And Theo, I don't want to hear that word come out of your mouth again, or I'm going to take your sneakers and throw them out with the trash. Do I make myself clear?" "I am out of here," Theo mutters. A moment later, I hear the door slam. I've met so many parents of kids who are on the low end of the autism spectrum, kids who are diametrically opposed to Jacob with his Asperger's. They tell me I'm lucky to have a son who's so verbal, who's blisteringly intelligent, who can take apart the broken microwave and have it working again an hour later. They think there's no greater hell than having a son who's locked in his own world, unaware that there's a wider one to explore. But try having a son who's locked in his own world and wants to make a connection. A son who tries to be like everyone else but truly doesn't know how. "You missed a fingerprint too," Jacob says cheerfully. "No offense, Mom, but you would make a lousy crime scene investigator." "You never did tell me Theo's motive for killing you." "Oh," Jacob glances over his shoulder, a wicked grin spreading across his face. "I stole his sneakers." In my mind, Asperger's is a label to describe not the traits Jacob has, but rather the ones he lost. It was somewhere around 2 years old when he began to drop words, to stop making eye contact, to avoid connections with people. He couldn't hear us, or he didn't want to. One day I looked at him, lying on the floor beside a Tonka truck. He was spinning its wheels, his face inches away, and I thought, "Where have you gone?" I made excuses for his behavior. The reason he was huddled in the bottom of the grocery cart every time we went shopping was that it was cold in the market. The tags I had to cut out of his clothing were unusually scratchy. There's a lot of fuss about whether or not Asperger's is on the autism spectrum, but to be honest, it doesn't matter. It's a term we use to get Jacob the accommodations he needs in school, not a label to explain who he is. If you met him now, the first thing you'd notice is that he might have forgotten to change his shirt from yesterday or brush his hair. He won't look you in the eye. And if you pause to speak to someone else for a brief moment, you might turn back to find that Jacob has left the room. Saturdays, Jacob and I go food shopping. It's part of his routine, which means we rarely stray from it. I knew he'd have his faux crime scene completely cleaned up before 11 o'clock, because that's when the free sample lady sets up her table in the front of the Townsend Food Co-op. But today, the spot that she usually occupies is empty. Jacob's hand begins to flap against his leg. When a low growl rips through his throat, I know we're past the point of no return. He backs away from me into a shelf full of pickle jars. A few bottles fall to the floor, and the breaking glass sends him over the edge. Suddenly, Jacob is screaming. He moves blindly, striking out at me when I reach for him. It's only 30 seconds, but 30 seconds can last forever when you're the center of everyone's scrutiny, when you're wrestling your 6-foot-tall son down to the floor and pinning him with your full body weight, the only kind of pressure that can soothe him. A crowd has gathered around us. "He's autistic," I snap. "You have any questions?" I've found that anger works best. It's the electric shock they need to tear their gaze away from the train wreck. Jacob shuffles along behind me as I push the cart. His hand is still twitching faintly at his side, but he's holding it together. My biggest hope for Jacob is that moments like this won't happen. My biggest fear, that they will, and I won't always be there to keep people from thinking the worst. This is Jacob. "I may be autistic, but I can't tell you what day of the week your mother's 32nd birthday fell on. I can't do logarithms in my head. On the other hand, I could tell you anything you ever wanted to know about lightning, famous movie quotes, and lower Cretaceous sauropods. I memorized the periodic table without trying, I taught myself how to read Middle Egyptian, and I helped my calculus teacher fix his computer. I could talk forever about friction ridge detail in fingerprint analysis, and whether said analysis is an art or a science. I suppose these talents would make me a hit at a cocktail party if A, I drank, which I don't, or B, I had any friends to invite me to a party, cocktail or not. My mother's explained it to me this way. Imagine what it's like to have someone with an intense stare come up to you and start talking about medium velocity impact blood spatter patterns. Then again, imagine being the person talking and not getting the hint when the victim of your conversation is desperately trying to escape. I was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome long before it became the mental health disorder du jour, overused by parents to describe their bratty kids, so people think they're super geniuses instead of simply antisocial. To be honest, most kids in my school know what Asperger's is now, thanks to a candidate on America's Next Top Model. As for myself, I try not to say the word out loud. Asperger's. I mean, doesn't it sound like a grade Z cut of meat? I live with my brother and my brother Theo. The fact that we emerge from the same gene pool is mind-boggling to me because we couldn't be more different. Theo is always caught up in what other people think of him, while I already know what people think of me, that I'm the weird kid who stands too close and doesn't shut up. Theo listens to rap, which gives me a headache. He skateboards as if the wheels are attached to his feet, and I mean that as a compliment, since I can barely walk and chew gum. He puts up with a lot, I suppose. I get upset if plans don't work out or something in my schedule changes, and sometimes I just can't control what happens. I go all Hulk, screaming, swearing, hitting things. I haven't ever hit Theo, but I've wrecked some of his things, most notably a guitar that my mother made me pay for in increments. Theo is also the one who suffers the brunt of my honesty. Case in point number one. Theo walks into the kitchen wearing jeans so low his underwear is showing, an oversized sweatshirt, and some weird metal around his neck. Theo. Sup. Me. Yo, homie, maybe you didn't get the memo, but we live in suburbia, not the hood. I tell my mother we have nothing in common, but she insists that will change. I think she's crazy. I treat school like an anthropological study. I tried to cultivate an interest in topics that normal kids talked about, but it was so boring. Case in point number two. Girl. Hey, Jacob, isn't this the coolest MP3 player? Me. It was probably made by Chinese kids. Girl. You want a sip of my slushie? Me. Sharing drinks can give you mono, so can kissing. Girl, I'm gonna go sit somewhere else. Can you blame me for trying to jazz up conversations with my peers a little by talking about topics like Dr. Henry Lee's take on the Lacey Peterson murder? Eventually, I gave up. Following a discussion about who was going out with whom was as hard for me as cataloging the mating rituals of a nomadic tribe in Papua New Guinea. My mother says sometimes I don't even try. I say I try all the time. There are some things I really can't stand. One, the sound of paper being crumpled. It makes me feel like someone's doing that to my organs. Two, too much noise or flashing lights. Three, having plans change. Four, missing Crime Busters, which is on the USA Network at 4:30 every day thanks to the wonders of syndication. Even though I know all 114 of the episodes by heart, watching them daily is as important to me as taking insulin would be to a diabetic. Five, when my mother puts my clothes away. I keep them in rainbow order, Roy G. Biv, and the colors can't touch. She does her best, but the last time she completely forgot about indigo. Six, if someone else takes a bite of my food, I have to cut off the part his saliva touched before I can eat any more of it. Seven, loose hair. It freaks me out. Eight, being touched by someone I don't know. Nine, food with membranes like custards or foods that explode in your mouth like peas. 10, even numbers. 11, when people call me retarded, which I am not. 12, the color orange. It means danger, and there's no rhyme for it in English, which makes it suspicious. I have spent much of my 18 years learning how to exist in a world that is occasionally orange, chaotic, and too loud. In between classes, for example, I wear headphones. I used to wear this great pair that made me look like an air traffic controller, but Theo said everyone made fun of me when they saw me in the halls, so my mother convinced me to use earbuds instead. I hardly ever go to the cafeteria because there's no one for me to sit with, and all those conversations crossing each other feel like knives on my skin. Instead, I hang out in the teacher's room, where if I happen to mention that Pythagoras did not really discover the Pythagorean theorem, they don't look at me like I've grown a second head. When I get upset, I repeat words from movie scripts and talk in a flat voice. I close my eyes and ask myself, what would Dr. Henry Lee do? My psychiatrist, Dr. Moon Murano, often asks me to rate anxiety-producing situations on a scale of 1 to 10. Today's a 1, thanks to the absence of the free sample lady at the grocery store. I've been in my room since we got home. Hey, my mother says, poking her head in. How you doing? Okay. She sits down beside me on the bed. So, Jacob, she says, I just want to point out that you did, in fact, survive without the free food sample. It's times like this I'm glad I don't look people in the eye. If I did, surely they would die on the spot from the contempt shooting out of mine. Teachable moment, my mother explains. Just saying. Frankly, my dear, I tell her, I don't give a damn. My mother sighs. Dinner at 6, Rhett, she says, even though it's always at 6, and even though my name is Jacob. For my birthday last year, my mother bought me the most incredible gift ever, a police scanner radio. Since Thanksgiving alone, I've gone to 2 crime scenes. The first was a break-in at a jewelry store. The second crime scene was not really a crime scene. It was the house of a kid who goes to my school, who's a real jerk to me. His mother had called 911, but by the time they got there, she was standing at the front door, her nose still bleeding, saying she didn't want to press charges against her husband. Tonight, I've just gotten into my pajamas when I hear a code on the scanner, 10100, which means dead body. I don't think I've ever gotten dressed so fast in my life. I grab a composition notebook and I scrawl down the address that keeps getting mentioned on the scanner. Then I tiptoe downstairs. With any luck, my mother's already asleep and won't know I'm gone. It's bitterly cold out, and there are about 2 inches of snow on the ground. I'm so excited about the crime scene, I'm wearing sneakers instead of boots. The wheels of my mountain bike skid every time I go around a turn. The address is a state highway, and I know I've reached the right spot because there are 4 police cars with their flashing blues on. An abandoned car, a Pontiac, sits on the side of the road covered in ice and snow. I take out my notebook and write, "Vehicle has been abandoned for at least 12 hours pre-storm." I duck into the edge of the woods as another police car arrives. This one is unmarked and ordinary, except for the dome police light magnetically affixed to the top. The man who gets out of it is tall and has red hair. He's wearing a black overcoat and heavy boots. On one of his hands, he is wearing a Dora the Explorer Band-Aid. I write this in my notebook, too. Captain, an officer says, coming out from between the trees. Sorry to call you in. The captain shakes his head. What you got? Jogger found a body in the woods. The guy's half naked and there's blood all over him. I follow them into the woods, careful to stay in the shadows. The dead man is lying on his back. His eyes are open. His pants are gathered around his ankles, but he's still wearing his underwear. The knuckles of his hands are bright red with blood, as are the palms, knees, and calves. His jacket is unzipped, and he's missing one shoe and one sock. All around him, the snow is pink. Holy crap, the captain says. He kneels down and snaps on a pair of rubber gloves. I hear two more sets of footsteps, and another man comes into the pool of light. Jesus, H, the other man says. Hey, Chief. Suicide or homicide? I don't know yet. Sexual assault seems like a given, though. Rich, the guy's covered in blood from head to toe, and he's lying here in his tighty whities. You think he got sexually assaulted and then committed harakiri? I look down at the list in my notebook. What would Dr. Henry Lee do? Well, he'd analyze why there was only superficial blood, that pink transfer on the snow without any dripping or spatter. He'd note the footprints in the snow. He'd ask why, after a sexual assault, the victim would still be wearing his underwear if other items of clothing were removed. I am so cold, I'm shaking. I stomp my frozen feet in their sneakers. Then I look down at the ground, and suddenly, everything is crystal clear. Actually, I say, stepping out from my hiding place, you're both wrong. This is Rich. Who the hell are you? The chief asks. It's really very simple, the boy continues, staring at the body. On episode 26 of season 2, the whole Crime Busters team got hauled up to Mount Washington to investigate a naked guy who was found at the summit. No one could figure out what a naked guy was doing on top of a mountain, but it turned out to be hypothermia. The same thing happened to this man. He became disoriented and fell down. As his core body temperature rose, he took off his own clothes because he felt hot, but in reality, that's what made him freeze to death. He grins. I can't believe you guys didn't know that. The chief narrows his eyes. What's your name? Jacob. People who freeze to death don't usually bleed all over the place. But he didn't bleed all over the place, Jacob says. Blood spatter would show up in the snow. Look at the wounds. He fell down and scraped himself up. The blood on the snow came from crawling around before he lost consciousness. I look at Jacob carefully. One major flaw with his theory, of course, is that you don't spontaneously start bleeding when you crawl around on the snow. If that were the case, there'd be hundreds of school children exsanguinating at recess during winter in Vermont. There's just something the tiniest bit off about him. His voice is too flat and high. He won't make eye contact. He's bouncing on the balls of his feet, and I don't even think he realizes it. On the spot where he's been bouncing, the snow is melted, revealing a patch of briars. I kick at the ground beneath my boots and shake my head. That poor, drunk, dead bastard had the misfortune to fall down in a field of brambles. Before I can say anything else, Wayne Nussbaum, the regional medical examiner, arrives. Greetings, all. I hear you have a murder mystery on your hands. You think it could be a hypothermia, I say. He considers this, carefully rolling the victim forward. I've never seen it firsthand, but certainly would fit the bill. Wayne glances up at me. Nice work, but you didn't need to pull me away from the Bruins in overtime for death by natural causes. I glance at the spot where Jacob was standing, but he has disappeared. And finally, this is Jacob. I pedal home as fast as I can. I can't wait to transcribe my notes from the crime scene into a fresh notebook. I plan to draw pictures using colored pencils and scaled maps. I slip into the house through the garage, and I'm just taking off my sneakers when the door opens behind me again. Immediately, I freeze. It's my brother, Theo. What if he asked me what I've been doing? I've never been a very good liar. If he asks, I'm going to have to tell him about the scanner and the dead body and the hypothermia, and that makes me angry because right now I want to keep it all to myself instead of sharing it. I tuck my notebook into my pants and pull my sweater down over it. What, now you're going to spy on me? Theo says, kicking off his boots. Why don't you get a life? It isn't until he's halfway up the stairs that I look at him and see how red his cheeks are, how his hair is windblown. I wonder where he's been and if Mom knows, and then the thought is gone, replaced by the vision of the dead man's bare skin and the pink-stained snow. I'm still humming under my breath when I get to my room. I take off my clothes and put on my pajamas. Then I sit down at my desk. Go figure. On a scale of 1 to 10, this day turned out to be an 11. Thank you. So I hope you enjoyed hearing from Jacob as much as I enjoyed writing him. He is a great character and one of my all-time favorite narrators. And this is now the part of the program where you guys get to ask me anything at all. There's only one rule for this part of the program, which is if you give away the ending of a book, I am going to do serious bodily harm to you. Serious. And I'm not joking. So has anyone got a question for me? Yeah. where did I start regarding my research for this book? Well, I actually started from a personal level because there is autism in my family too. My cousin David is profoundly autistic, and he was adopted by my aunt and uncle, and many times over the course of his life, my aunt would find herself having to control a very public meltdown, and there were times she had to restrain David or sit on David. She has had the cops called on her. She has been accused of child abuse. This is very familiar to parents of children with autism. David grew up. David is now about 30 years old, and he lives in a group home. He is about 6'5", and he weighs over 200 pounds. And when David gets frustrated, things are a little different. And he has put his hand through walls and through plate glass windows. And when that happens, the owner of the group home has to call the police because she has to file a police report to get the insurance coverage. And the police can't figure it out. David can't communicate to them why he's upset, and the police don't know how to ask him questions, and so there's a complete breakdown. And that was really the beginning point for me. But I knew I wanted a narrator who could communicate very well, and that meant I had to move from the low end of the autism spectrum into the high end. But I didn't have personal experience with Asperger's. So I began by going to a school outside of Pittsburgh that is a school for children with autism. And I have been put in touch with six teenagers who all have Asperger's syndrome. I interviewed them individually, and I also interviewed their parents individually. And interestingly, they were not very successful interviews because, of course, one of the diagnostic criteria for Asperger's is that inability to deal with the social interaction. So many times they didn't know how to answer me, or they would give me a one-word answer, and it was like coaxing, you know, blood out of a stone. But I needed that experience so that I could write someone like Rich, who meets someone like Jacob and has to figure out what this kid's like, what makes him different, how he can't quite put his finger on what's different. Then I went back home. Now, I live in New Hampshire, and I contacted the Autism Association of New England, and I wound up getting 35 more teenagers with Asperger's syndrome and their parents to agree to fill out a very detailed questionnaire for me. And I literally got back hundreds and hundreds of pages in response. Because, as you can tell from Jacob's voice, these kids who can't really communicate face-to-face are really, really smart and can communicate on their own terms in their own way, either online or through their writing. And this is one of the reasons that the rise of the internet has been so important to people with Asperger's. It takes away the social connection of an interaction. So these kids wrote me literally hundreds of pages with details about their lives. And a lot of the details wound up in the book. Like the boy who told me about his mom, who had said they were moving to Vermont, and he was going to love it because there was lots of green space and rolling hills. And he freaked out because he thought, rolling hills, they're going to hurt us. You know, how am I going to survive? Or the mom who, after years of not really ever knowing whether her son loved her, said, just once, you know, just once, I would love it if you could bring me a Mother's Day card. Just get me a Mother's Day card. And she forgot about it, and a couple of months later on Mother's Day, her son presented her with a Mother's Day card. Not signed, not in an envelope, just a Mother's Day card. And so a lot of those details, you know, wound up in the actual book itself. So really, for me, the beginning of the research for this was to talk and to listen to kids who have Asperger's. One of the girls who I interviewed was such a good writer. She alone gave me about 250 pages of research. And I found myself at different points when I was writing, shooting her a quick email to say, what do you think of this? Would you react this way? How would Jacob phrase this? And she was so helpful to me that when I finished the book, I asked if she would be willing to read it for accuracy, and she did. And she would tell me places where Jacob's voice was saying something that she herself would have thought. She would tell me places where it didn't work for her. And then there were times that her Asperger's would show, and she wouldn't understand a metaphor, and I would have to explain it to her. And because of her very careful read, I believe 100% that Jacob's voice is a very accurate one. And since the book has come out at the beginning of March, I've heard from a couple of dozen people with Asperger's who've read it, who said that it does sound very realistic to them. It's what they sound like. Yes. Oh, excellent. Well, thank you. That really wasn't a question. It was just her telling me how great I am, so we don't have to repeat that. Yes. Out of all the books I've written, which one is my personal favorite? My personal favorite is Second Glance. It had some of the most fun research I've ever done in my life. It covers a period of history very few people know about in America when we were in the business of racial hygiene before Hitler was. It has very unique characters, and technically it was a hard book to write, and I feel like I pulled it off. So for very writerly reasons, I love that book. But you are allowed to have a different favorite as long as it is still a PICO title. So. Yeah. You know, I have to tell you, the question is, what did I think of the My Sister's Keeper movie? I've been on tour now since March 2nd. That question comes up within the first four of every event. So thanks for keeping it, you know, right where it's supposed to be. Well, perhaps those of you who saw the My Sister's Keeper movie noticed the ending was different. Yeah? Right. So the deal with selling the rights to a movie from a book are that you as an author have absolutely no control. And most readers don't realize that. They think they ask us for our advice, but they really don't want anything to do with us. And it's a little bit like giving a baby up for adoption. You want to hope that you're giving it to a good home, and sometimes you find out that your baby had a great life and went to college and got a great job, and sometimes you find out that she grew up with a crack whore, and that's the way it works. And, you know, the truth is that my experience with My Sister's Keeper tended toward the latter. I had a director, Nick Cassavetes, who is an extremely talented director who's made some great films. But Nick told me to my face that he was keeping the ending, because I made it very clear that I thought that was really integral to the story. And he said to me, that is the right ending for the book, and I will not change it unless I tell you myself and I tell you why. And I thought, that's very fair. And he went off, and the way I found out the ending was being changed was from a fan who worked at a casting agency and read the script. And I called Nick, and I said, what's going on? And he wouldn't talk to me. So I went to the set, and I said, what's going on? And he wouldn't talk to me and threw me off the set. And to this day, I still do not know why he changed the ending of that story. What I do know is this, that when you have millions of people who read a book and enjoy it around the world, and your target demographic of moviegoers for an audience are the people who love that book, why on earth would you mess with a good thing? So, yes. So tell me if I'm paraphrasing this right, but you really want to know, what's the secret to choosing a topic that will engage both women and men so that both of their points of view are represented and a discussion can ensue, right? Good, okay. I'm just editing your question down, don't feel bad. So what this gentleman was saying is, looking around, it looks like most of my fans are women. I'm going to tell you that I decided one day I was going to do an experiment, and I kept track of my fan mail that comes in. I get about 200 letters a day. I answer every single one of them. If you have received a response from me, it truly is me. I do not have an assistant. 49% of my email comes from men. So women come to events, and what I think that means is that you all need to get out more, you know, right? And because I think a lot of men are like, oh, I must be her only male fan. That's not true, but so be secure in your masculinity. You're among, you know, you're in good hands here. As for writing, choosing a topic that really affects both, the best way I can describe it is that what the men write to me in those letters is really different than what the women write to me in those letters. The women identify with the characters who are mothers, who are worried that they can't do it all, you know, who worry about their kids and the problems facing their kids. The men identify with the father figures in the book, and they worry that they're not spending enough time with their kids. They worry that they don't have the same relationship with their children that a mother does. They worry that they can't keep their kids safe. And it's amazing how they'll just pour out their hearts on a page to me. But I think the secret is to write a book that makes sure to espouse many different points of view. I write about very controversial things, but with any luck, when you read them, I'm not preaching to you. It's really up to you to hear everyone's point of view and then make a decision yourself who's in the right and who's in the wrong, you know, if that's possible. Because of that, there are so many different points of view for you as a fan to come in and attach yourself to in the book. It's also why. I have fans who write to me and say, I only read mystery novels, you are my favorite mystery writer. And I have people who write to me and say, I only read courtroom thrillers, you are my favorite courtroom thriller novelist. And I don't ever say, I don't believe I have one genre. In fact, I had a guy come up to me yesterday and say, this is the best mystery I've read all year. Have your publishers submitted you for an Edgar Award? And I said, no, and I really don't want them to, because I wouldn't want to be pigeonholed into that genre, no more than I would want to be pigeonholed as a woman's fiction writer as opposed to an anyone's fiction writer. So I think it's just a matter of not necessarily how you what topic you choose, but making sure that every character gets a fair shake and a voice in the story. Yes. Sure. Who do I read? Who do I like to read? This poor girl has been ruined for fiction by my books because they're so good. And so she wants recommendations. Yeah, the people I read do tend to write things similar to what I do, in the sense that they write about things that take ordinary people and put them into pretty extraordinary circumstances and kind of see how they fare. Some of my favorite writers, my all-time favorite is Alice Hoffman. I just love her writing. Chris Bojalian is a wonderful novelist who has a new book out called Secrets of Eden that's very good. Recently, I've gotten into the backlist of a writer named Caroline Levitt, who is a wonderful writer, who for some reason, everything she writes makes me cry. Not like she's writing about sad things, but the way she describes things are beautiful. And I think more people should know about her, so you should definitely check her out. There's going to be a mad rush on the Levitt books at the library, I can feel it. I read Sue Miller, I read Ann Tyler, I read Anita Shreve, I read a lot of people who I think write about family and about what happens when things go wrong within a family. So those would be some good starters for you. Thank you. It was more of a comment too. She just thinks I rock. But it was about the idea of getting into someone's head in a particularly difficult situation. And I wouldn't write the book if I couldn't do that. You know, for My Sister's Keeper, which is the book you were talking about, I spent a lot of time with pediatric cancer patients and their families. I also had personal experiences with one of my own sons who did not have cancer, but had congenital tumors in his ears that required him to have a lot of surgeries. So I do know what it's like as a mom to spend a lot of time in a hospital, and a lot of that figured into the book as well. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. When I write for multiple first-person narrators, what makes me decide to go that route? And there actually is something very specific that makes me think that's the right format for a book. Usually, it's that I don't feel one character has the entire story, that they have a very particular bias, or they have blinders on, like Sarah in My Sister's Keeper, and you literally need everyone's point of view in order to get the whole story. I always think about it like sewing together a quilt. You know, you've got this one perfect, beautiful little quilt square, but it sure isn't going to keep you warm. And what you really need are multiple quilt squares, and then when you attach them all together, all of a sudden you have a blanket. And that's a little bit what multiple first-person narratives feel like for me when I'm creating a story. They all have a tiny piece of that puzzle, and they're putting it together for you. In the green, yeah? The question is about repeated characters, and I do every now and then bring a character back, but I do not write sequels. And there is nothing on my website right now that says read Perfect Match before you read 19 Minutes. And the reason for that is because, like you said, my book should stand alone. If I am bringing a character back, I will give you enough information about that character in the new book for you to have a perfectly engaging reading experience without feeling like you missed something. And then, you know, if you go back, you're like, oh yeah, wow, this is really cool. This is what got him to that point. But I don't feel like you do have to read them in any order. I think you can just, you know, grab whatever one's on your shelf and enjoy it. Let's see, way in the back there. Gosh, that's a really good question. If House Rules was going to be a movie, would I have any choices for actors to play certain roles? It's a really plum role for a woman playing Emma and a guy playing Jacob. There's no question about that. I think of... I'm going to date myself now. Remember the movie What's Eating Gilbert Grape? Yeah? Remember Leo DiCaprio in that role? Wasn't he good? I would love to see an actor who, you know, you think of as like some kind of heartthrob actor doing a role like Jacob, because I think it would be fascinating to watch. I haven't dream cast this one in my head yet. I would like to go out on a limb and say I would prefer that Cameron Diaz not play Emma. How's that? And yes, you are next. What advice would I give to an aspiring writer? I do have some pretty specific advice. The first thing is carve out time to write every day, whether it is 10 minutes, you know, before you go to bed or wake up in the morning. Don't do anything but write. Don't talk to your brother. Don't answer your email. Don't get on your phone and text. Just write, because you need to develop that fluidity in writing. If you can, take a workshop course. I don't believe that you need an MFA or a PhD or anything to be a writer, but you do need to go through some kind of process where you learn how to give and get criticism, because it's a brutal business and you're going to hear no a lot, and you've got to be your own best editor. So a workshop course is critical. They now offer them at schools, at high schools even. They offer them at colleges. They offer them at bookstores. They offer them online. You can find one if you work hard enough. And the other advice I give is that when you start writing something and you stop because you're convinced it's truly the crummiest piece of anything ever written in the history of English literature, don't throw it out. Make yourself get all the way to the end so that you know that you can. The real reason you're not finishing has nothing to do with the piece. It has to do with the fact that if you get to the end and it's not as good as you thought it was, you can't believe in yourself anymore. So force yourself to get to the end and then look at it and say, I'm going to throw it out, or I'm going to fix it. But if you don't get to that point, you'll never know if you can. And that's a really important psychological barrier that you need to cross. Yes. Do I have a Kindle? You know, I have to tell you, this has only come up on the West Coast, which is really interesting. I do have a Kindle. And, you know, the interesting thing about Kindles is that, as many of you know, there is a huge battle right now between publishers and Amazon. And my book, House Rules, is one of the fallen soldiers in the casualties because it is not out on the Kindle yet. And from what I hear, it's coming out at the beginning of April. I'll believe that when I see it. But I have been very vocal in my opposition to the publisher's decision to not release this on Kindle. It is my opinion that the people who have a Kindle are your best readers. They're the ones who want a book immediately. So you don't punish your best readers by withholding the really popular fiction. That said, publishers are being squeezed dry right now by Amazon. They are losing money on their titles. And the real problem is that the publishers gave away something for free that they just didn't think was going to be a big deal. When they first negotiated with Amazon, they were like, yeah, whatever, because who knew e-readers were going to be around to stay? And they have come around to stay. And unfortunately, the publishing business is a dinosaur and needs to catch up a little bit and realize that we are going to be taking in our reading in many different formats. I think there's going to be something that changes it up a little bit. A lot of people, including my publisher, feel the iPad will unlock that jam a little bit and will force Amazon to renegotiate with some of the publishers. I asked my publisher, I said, well, okay, so you've got an iPad, which is great, but what's different about reading a book on the iPad than the Kindle? Why should I pay $15.99 instead of $9.99? And my publisher said, well, the iPad's in color. And I said, well, the book's in black and white. So I don't know. I'm still waiting for this one. I don't think we've seen the last of this. And to be honest, the ebook industry is changing daily. It changes every single day. And there will be deals struck. I just don't think that they've been struck yet. What's important for you guys to know as readers is this. You can't blame us as the authors, because the ebook rights for a particular book like House Rules were sold in a contract that was negotiated 3 years ago. So I don't have any right to tell my publisher, you need to get this out on the Kindle right now, because they already own these rights, and who knew that we would be in this situation 3 years later. I think what you'll see is a lot of authors from now on, including me, retaining ebook rights so that we can work through this mess without having to deal with the publisher getting into a bullying position. But that's going to take a while as we all renegotiate our contracts for future books. In the green. I'm so glad you asked. Do I have another book that I'm working on now? Yes, and in fact, I'm really excited about this book, so I love to talk about it. It is called Sing You Home, and it is about something that I have wanted to write about for a very long time, and I kind of am still a little flummoxed by the fact that this hasn't been written about yet. The book is about embryo donation and gay rights in America. And it is really good. I've finished the first couple drafts, so I could tell you that with authority. But what I think is really important about the book is that, for me, gay rights has become so politicized that we tend to forget it is not a political platform, but it's really about people who are just trying to do things that most of us are lucky enough to take for granted. And I really wanted to bring that voice of a person who's struggling with all this down to the level of a reader. Now, y'all know I write first-person narratives, and you would think that might be good enough, but to me it wasn't. I really needed you to hear a voice. The main character in Sing You Home is Zoe, and she is a musician and a music therapist. And packaged with every book will be a CD of original music that was written by me and a friend of mine. And my friend, who is a musician, is the voice, you know, quote-unquote, of Zoe in this book. Instead of there being chapter titles, there are track titles. And with every track, you will see how she's processing what's going on in the book through her music. And I think it's going to make the reading experience very different, and actually a really good one for the iPad, come to think of it. But because of that, you will literally hear the voice of this woman. And when I tour next year for this book, you won't just have to listen to me, because I will be bringing the musician with me, and we'll have a little bit of a live music session as well, which will be really fun. So, yeah. In the purple. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh gosh, you know, I'm trying really hard. How do I get back to Portland? You know, I there are places I really wish I could go everywhere, you know, that would fit in a book tour. Well, not all places. Like, I don't really ever want to go to Mississippi again, ever. But I'm going to tell you my Mississippi tour story. This was the weirdest experience I've ever had on book tour. So I told you I'm from New Hampshire. I am going to get back to your question. But I told you I'm from New Hampshire, right? So I go to Mississippi, which is a really bizarre place because they don't really have readings there. You sit down with a bookseller and you drink sweet tea, and I don't even like sweet tea. And so my media escort, which is someone who drives you around to all your different interviews and to your bookstore events, is this retired fireman. He's in his 60s. He's this big, burly guy, you know. And so he's driving me around. And at one point, right before I was scheduled to leave Mississippi, he says to me, "So, does the Deep South look like you thought it was going to look?" And so I said, you know, I'm looking around. I said, honestly, it doesn't. I mean, there are all these strip malls, and I guess I was kind of expecting plantations, you know, because I'd never been there before. He pulls the car over to the side of the road, locks the doors, turns off the engine, and goes, "You burned them all." I was like, could you get back on the road, please? It was really scary. So, no, I'm not going back to Mississippi, but Portland has never done that to me. So, and I actually would really like to get back to Portland for next year's book. I'm going to try to make it happen. The truth is that I have a very limited window, you know, of when I can actually tour, and based around the lives of my children mostly. And I really hope to get out there because it is a town that I think would be very supportive of a book that is about gay rights. And I think it would be a great place to go. So hopefully you won't have to make the trip next year. Let's see. Yep. That's a funny story. Do I get to pick the fonts for my characters? I was the one who came up with the idea of changing the fonts for different narrators, because I think for some people, reading is a very visual thing. And although you should be able to pick this up at any point and say, oh, that's Jacob talking, or oh, that's Emma talking, sometimes it helps to have that visual cue. So every year, my editor and I tell production, we need 5 fonts. We need 4 fonts. You know, they all have to look really different. And every single year, they come back to us with 4 fonts that look exactly the same. And I'm like, really, how hard is this? Right? So every year my editor and I sit down and we go over the fonts until we find 4 that look, you know, particularly different. So I do choose them, but only because the production team doesn't seem to be doing a very good job of it. I think we can take about 3 more questions. Yep. Which character do I identify the most with and why? To be honest, I don't identify with many of my characters, which is really good because they live awful lives and I don't. You know, so that's a good thing. But the one that I usually say shocks a lot of people because people hate her, and that's Nina Frost from Perfect Match. Nina Frost is this prosecutor who thinks that her son is being molested by a local priest, and so she goes out and shoots the guy, only to find out she shot the wrong guy. She's really good at leaping to conclusions. I would think that maybe I am a little better at weighing ideas before I leap. But what I love about Nina is that she's smart, she definitely has her opinions, she is no nonsense, and you cross her with her kid and she's never going to forget it. And I would really like to believe that those are all qualities I have, even if I'm not particularly packing a pistol like she is. Yes. So the question is about the 10th circle, which is about date rape, and really about the stories that we tell ourselves in our lives. What I was thinking when I was writing that book was, how do we tell a story? How do we take in a story? I think a little bit of the 10th Circle when I think of the new book, Sing You Home, because again, it's a different media format attached to a book. The main character in the 10th Circle is a dad named Daniel Stone, whose daughter Trixie is 14, I think, and is date raped. And Daniel is very quiet and reclusive and can't tell you how he feels, but he can show you because he is a comic book artist, and embedded in the text is this comic book. You have to read it to understand how he's feeling about what happened to his daughter. And, you know, for me, I was thinking about the stories that we tell. I was thinking about how we tell a story. I chose the comic book format because I really liked that idea of a visual way to tell a story that had no words in it. I also really wanted to play around with Dante's Inferno, which became the story that Daniel uses in his comic book, his graphic novel. But when you think about the 10th circle of hell, which is one more than Dante gave us, what would that be? What would be worse than betraying your benefactor, which is the 9th circle of hell, and which, you know, really winds, makes you wind up attached to the devil at the neck for eternity, according to Dante? Well, for me, I think it's telling lies to yourself and allowing yourself to believe them. And that is a journey that every single main character in that book, whether it's Laura, the mother, Daniel, the father, or Trixie, all have to face somewhere in the context of the story. And it's our last question, so it's a really good one, right? All right, go for it. I do! Okay, this is a total Seattle thing, yeah. So this woman heard a rumor that I have my own iPhone app. I'm just saying, come on. So this is what happened. This is actually really funny. I don't know who came up with this brilliant plan at the publisher, but they decided I should have an iPhone app. And that apparently costs a great deal of money to develop. I really had very little to do with it, except for the fact that I thought, great, more work for me, because I have to provide content. And it is actually pretty cool in that it takes all the content and puts it in one place. My favorite part of the iPhone app is that you can punch one area that says something about events, and it tells you where I'm doing an event, and then uses Google Maps to get you there, which I find very useful because I never know where I'm going. So that's a good thing. But it also links to my Twitter page and everything. And the cool thing is that there are some things on there that aren't on my website and that are unique and different. There are recipes that are kind of our favorite recipes in my family. There are some pictures from family vacations. One of the things I do as an avocation is write original children's musicals, and they are performed for charity. And you get to hear a little bit about two of the musicals and some of the cast singing from the original cast recordings we've done. And those are really fun. So it's a little bit more than what you would get, you know, on my website. What I will say is this. The funny part is that they released the app without letting me look at it. And it was like a huge snafu. And the editor wouldn't even tell me. It happened when I was on book tour in New York, and everyone was like, oh my gosh, she's going to be really angry. And it was pretty awful, actually. I should have certainly been able to look at the content. But they got so excited about releasing it that they posted it to the iTunes store without ever thinking it would be approved that quickly, I guess. So I looked at it and I said, well, this is really great. But like, for example, there are these recipes and it doesn't tell you at all what they are or why they're on there. And if I were a fan, I'd be going, what the hell is this? So, you know, you might want to add this beginning page explaining what they are. And so we had to kind of make a couple of adjustments after the fact. It was a little bit like locking the barn door after that horse is gone. But it is kind of fun. And I was one of the first authors with a web page and an interactive website. So I feel very privileged to be one of the first authors with an app too. And this is the saddest part. I had to pay 99 cents for my own download. So thank you for coming today. Keep reading.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.